We do have a lot to cover, though. And so I was going to put some slides up there in order to take and put the verses on there, because there's a lot of verses we're going to cover today. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read out what the verse is, if you want to write it down. But Elizabeth has graciously volunteered to take and read the verses for us. And so she has got all the list, the verses written down there, and then we're going to go over this. But it's this Galatians thing is really interesting, because as we go on through it, we're seeing a different side of Paul than we may have seen. And actually what we're seeing is something that may be a little bit hard for us to swallow, but nevertheless it's true, and we'll get into that as we go along. But as a little quick review, if we go back through chapters 1 and the first half of chapter 2, we see that Paul marvels at how quickly the Galatian people had turned. And we've, in our preliminary studies of this, we've seen who the Galatian people were. At least who I believe they were, and seen the background that they may have had. And we've seen that they are more probably returning Israelites, along with a number of true non-Israelite people. You might call them true Gentiles that were drawn along with them, which is precisely what the prophecies would say, because God says that when he begins to draw Israel, the Gentiles are going to be drawn with him. So I would suspect this is exactly what we see there. We also see that the gospel, we went through what the gospel was and found that the gospel, the true gospel of God, is the gospel of the return or the restoration of the kingdom of Israel. This is what the disciples were looking forward to when they asked Yeshua just before he ascended to heaven. They said, "Will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" This is what they thought the kingdom was, the restoration of the kingdom to Israel. We saw that Paul had been given by revelation the understanding of what the gospel message was. He got it directly from Yeshua. He didn't get it from the rabbis. He didn't get it from the disciples themselves. He got it directly through God, from God, through revelation. And so this is how he came up with his understanding of it, which was quite different than what he believed before. But when he was persecuting the Christians, he was doing that because he thought they were getting actually in the way of bringing about the restoration of the kingdom, because they were introducing what he thought would be idolatry into the mix. And so now he sees things differently. And of course, we've already talked about that. We also saw that there was other messages being brought out at that time too, all other gospel messages. And Paul says it's not another gospel that's being preached. In fact, the one that was being preached to the Galatians, Paul says, was not another gospel, but instead it was a gospel with a little different twist to it. But this little different twist makes a big difference in the overall understanding of the gospel. And so this is why Paul is so upset about this. And as we left off, Paul was talking about those people. A delegation had come in to the congregation in Antioch, and they were introducing this twist of the gospel up there as well. Actually, maybe we didn't get to that point. But nevertheless, that's what we're getting ready to get into. But where we left off, we see that Paul was really upset about something. And as he continues to explain to the Galatian people about his view of the gospel, and he tries to support his gospel, now he's getting ready to get in and discuss this problem that came into the Antioch community, and what led at that time the Apostle Peter to commit a grievous act of hypocrisy. And so we're going to discuss that situation right now. So to start off, we'll start in Galatians chapter 2, and we're going to read from 11 through 13.
And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, and
Okay, now her, you are either, is that the New King James or the regular King James? Regular King James? Okay, the English Standard Version just goes ahead and calls the hypocrisy. This outright hypocrisy that Peter was involved in, and not only Peter, but those who came to Antioch, and even his friend Barnabas. So let's ask a few questions here to sort of set the stage for what's going on. First off, why was Peter in Antioch? Why was Peter even in Antioch? Okay, Peter, remember, was the disciple who, or the apostle sent to the circumcision, right? And Paul was the apostle sent to the uncircumcised. And we talked about this last time, that there's actually two different words there used. One word was the peritone, which is circumcised. But instead of the uncircumcised being a peritone, which is what the word should be in Greek, he uses the word akrostrubia, which is means a uncircumcised in heart, is basically what he's talking about there. But anyway, Peter's in Antioch. What's he doing in Antioch? Any ideas?
He's there because there must be a substantial community of the circumcised there.
Okay, that's a good thought. In fact, if we go to 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 1.
Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the strangers scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia.
Okay, so Peter was sent there. He sent a letter to these people. So obviously, since he was the apostle to the circumcision, he must have thought that there were some circumcised Jewish-leaning people in those areas. So that's one reason why. And there's another reason why. If Paul was sent, or Peter was sent to the Jews, where were most of the Jews?
Weren't they in Jerusalem?
At that time, there were more Jews in Egypt than there was in Israel. And there was more Jews in Babylon than there was in Israel. The greatest amount of Jews in the first century were in Babylon still. And that's why we have the Babylonian Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud came out first because it was where most of the Jews were. So if Peter was sent to the Jews, then he would certainly have had to go to at some point in the game, he would have had to have gone to Egypt, because remember, Yeshua went to Egypt. You know, his parents went to Egypt when he was threatened to be killed. And then, of course, and then Babylon was where most of the Jews were. Go back in your history a little bit of the history of Israel. Before Israel, or before Judah was taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar, a great contingency of Jews left Judea and went to Egypt to avoid being captured. And when they were there, as a result of them being there, is why we've come up with the Septuagint. Because the Septuagint was written for these Greek-speaking Jews in Egypt. But then Nebuchadnezzar comes along, and he takes a remnant of Judah, takes them to Babylon. Okay, or it wasn't actually a remnant of Judah, it was the majority of Judah. He takes them to Babylon. So you have Jews in Babylon, you have Jews in Egypt, and a very few Jews in Israel. And then when Cyrus of Persia took and allowed the Jews to go back, if you remember the story, only a very few of them went back. And that's why we have the story of Esther. Because if all the Jews had gone back to Israel, then there wouldn't have been any left in Persia, and there wouldn't have been any story of Esther and Mordecai. Yeah. So there wouldn't have been a Purim story. So there'd been one less party. So anyway, so God gave us a party by keeping them there. No. But anyway, so if Peter had gone to Babylon, then it was sort of on the way. Because as they go up the King's Highway before they head east, they're up in that area where Antioch was. And so that would have been another reason for them to go up there. But nevertheless, he found himself in Antioch. And he was visiting there in the congregation there in Antioch. More than likely a synagogue in Antioch. And just so happens Paul's there too at the same time. quite a coincidence. And so they're here they are, and they're in the synagogue here. And as is the custom of the synagogue, and especially today, they have what they call an oneg. And what does the Hebrew word oneg mean? Does anybody know? An oneg does not mean a meal. It means a Sabbath delight. It means a delight. God calls, when in Isaiah, God tells us that we should call the Sabbath an oneg, a delight. So, and we make a delight out of it by eating. So, this is a good thing to do. So they were there, and they were more than likely having an oneg in the afternoon. That's still a custom today in many Jewish synagogues to have a meal together in the afternoon. And so Peter was there, and there were some Jews there, and there were some non-Jews there. And they're all sitting together eating, and there's no problem between them. And there's no problem with Peter, because Peter, just a few years earlier, had a certain encounter with this fellow Cornelius. And as a result of that, Peter had a big change in his theology, because now he saw that, contrary to Jewish understanding, it was okay to eat with a non-Jew, something that was unheard of in Israel before that. In fact, Peter says, Elizabeth, verse Acts 10. Okay, so Peter, as a result of his experience with Cornelius, he realizes that God has not set off a people, or he has not made divisions based on race. There is no division based on race. Being a Jew did not make you better than an Ethiopian, didn't make you better than an Oriental, didn't make you better than anybody else. Being in God's eyes, the only difference is that you had a calling that the others didn't. But once you took and applied yourself to learning about God and His way, then there is no difference between you and a Jew in that regards. In fact, like Elizabeth said, but in every nation, anyone who fears Him and does what is right is acceptable to Him. So this is all that's required for you to be a part of the people of God. And this is what Peter had learned. And so Peter was practicing that when he went to Antioch. He didn't have any problem when he went to Antioch sitting down with people that were non-Jews and eating with them. But then we get down to verse 11. And in the Galatians 2, verse 11, it says, "But when..." And the Hebrew word there is hote dei. The Greek word is hote dei. And it's a very emphatic word. And it means, it's meant to bring about a tremendous contrast. Because if we read the story of what had happened up to that point, Peter was having no problem. But then Paul says, but when... certain men came from James. Actually, that's when the boat, Hotei Day is. But when certain men came from James, that changed things. Up until that time, those people in Jerusalem, Up until those people came from Jerusalem, Peter had no problem eating with non-Jews. But when they came, they changed something. Now, you've got to keep in mind what Peter had done and what Paul had just got through explaining. Paul had explained how when he came to the understanding of this walk, or the understanding that of the gospel message, remember, he took that gospel message to the disciples. They were the last ones that he took it to. He took it up to Jerusalem and he said, okay, this is the message that's been laid on my heart. How do you look at it? What do you think about this? And according to what Paul has already said in Galatians, he said they looked at it and they concurred. They agreed with him. And who are the three principal, Paul calls them pillars. Who are the three pillars that agreed with him? Peter, James, and John. All right. So Peter was there. Peter agreed that what Paul was saying was correct. In fact, they shook hands and they said, we're going to all teach the same thing. We're not going to teach a different thing to the Jews and something else to the Gentiles. We're all going to teach the same thing. We're all in agreement on this. And so when Peter got to Antioch there, when he arrived, Paul had already been there. He had been raising that group up and working with that group. And when Peter got there, he saw that there was no Jewish side, no non-Jewish side. Or there was no Jewish tables and there was no non-Jewish tables. They were all eating together. Everybody was eating together. And this is important to Paul that they all eat together because the table is where you learn. You know, they didn't have videotapes, CDs, DVDs, and everything back then. And they more than likely didn't have people standing up and preaching to them. Because the practice of the synagogue was to take and read the Torah. And then the discussion took place afterwards. And so they would sit down and they would have what's called table fellowship. And table fellowship was very important. Because that's where you sit down next to someone or across from someone and you toss out your ideas and they toss back their ideas and you sort of have a little bit of back and forth. You know, today after church when you go to an O'Neg, you're talking about this football player versus that football player and this ball game other than that ball game. Most people don't talk the Bible after church. It's all over with once the sermon's over with, you know. But these guys, I'm sure, they talked about the Bible. This is how they were learning and they were excited. And so they would sit down at the table because that's the only time they had together off probably during the whole week was during that Sabbath Oneg. And so it's important for the people to be able to sit together and talk. And also, being able to sit together it established a bond between people. When you sit down and talk and you share food together, establish a bond. That's why in families we try to sit down together and eat together. And so that's part of the advantage or the desire in having what we call table fellowship. And then another thing it does is it symbolizes a covenant and a covenant relationship. In fact, there is a covenant relationship that was created back in Genesis when Laban was chasing after Jacob, and after Jacob had taken his 12 sons with him and his two wives, and they had gone off, and Laban came, and all of a sudden, Jacob thought that Laban was going to try to kill him and all this stuff. But anyway, after they work it all out, they sit down together and they eat a meal, and it's talked about in Genesis 31:52. Elizabeth? Okay, so here's Laban and Jacob, and after they get their differences worked out, they sit down together, they had a sacrifice, they sat and ate a meal together, and so this was a sort of a covenant or a confirmation of the covenant that they made with each other. And so when you have the Jewish believers and the non-Jewish believers in the synagogue and an Oneg sitting apart from each other and sharing a meal together, it's sort of like they're building a covenant with each other, building a bond there that they wouldn't have otherwise. And we see this whole sitting down and eating a meal in regards to a covenant over and over again. Yeshua, on the night that he was crucified, he sat down, talked about the new covenant, and what did he do? He ate a meal with his disciples, right? So we see this over and over and over again in the scripture. So this is why it was so important for the Jews and the non-Jews to be able to eat together. But again, when these guys from Jerusalem came, or John, these guys, it says they came from James, came, things changed in that synagogue that they were in. Now, I want to bring out the point that these, even though the text says that they were from James, doesn't necessarily mean they were bringing a message from James. Or doesn't necessarily mean they represented James completely. They may have been sent by James, they may have been sent with a message, but they may have added their own message to whatever James sent them to do. Because we know that James did not agree with the message that these guys that came to Antioch had. We see that in Acts 15, verses 22 through 24. Now, Acts 15, 22, 24 could come before this point or could come after this point. It doesn't really matter. The point I'm wanting to make is simply this. Sometimes you send somebody to say something and they don't necessarily say what you ask them to say. Right? All right. And so this is what we see in Acts 15. Okay, so here James is saying, or whoever wrote this letter, is saying that, you know, they were sending this letter to Antioch, but they were saying that we've heard that people have come. They were representing us, but they didn't represent us correctly. They added things to what we told them, and they have troubled you by saying things that we have not said. So when these fellows come to Antioch, if they were indeed the same ones being spoken of in Acts 15, then we have a clear connection here. But nevertheless, it just points out the fact that it could happen, and probably did happen quite often, that people would add their own little twist to the message you've sent them to convey. And so when these fellows did come, and they gathered their little twist to whatever they were instructed to say, they came with an intent and a desire to convey their message as well, and they found willing ears when they got to Antioch. And those willing ears belonged to two very notable people in the scripture, Peter and Barnabas. So Peter and Barnabas both listened to what these fellows said, and as a result of it, they didn't necessarily, we don't know for sure that they believed what they heard, but they at least acted on what they heard. And we know then that they separated themselves off from the non-Jews. Because these guys were Jews. You know, Barnabas was a Levite. Peter was whatever Peter was. He may have been from Judah. We don't know for sure. But they separated themselves off. In fact, the Greek word that's used there for separated is Strong's number 873. It's aphorize, and it actually means to make a boundary. So it wasn't just that Peter moved away from them. He actually established a boundary between him and the non-Jews. So it was an intentional thing that Peter did. It was a calculated thing that Peter did. It wasn't just a very light thing that happened. And not only was Peter taken in this, the text goes on to say that Barnabas did the same, as well as the other Jews. And so what we see here happening is that here we had a happy congregation of people. There is no "you're better than me, I'm better than you," anything like that. And all of a sudden, when these guys come in, instead of Peter standing up to them, Peter went along with them. And now you've got all these non-Jews who are saying, now we are second-class citizens again. Now we're nothing again in the Jewish eyes. And so you've got years and years of work that was done, performed by Paul, to try to overcome this caste system that Judaism had been conveying for the last 250 to 300 years. Here we have Peter coming in here, and within just possibly a week, may have been more, probably more, but probably within maybe just a week, destroying it all, tearing it all down. So what happened to Peter? Why was it that Peter changed so quickly? Well, I tell you what, there's a few things we know about Peter. We know that Peter told Yeshua that he would never deny him. But yet, Peter did, twice. We know that Peter was the one who, after Yeshua died and was crucified, said, "I'm going fishing." He was gone. He was out of there. So Peter had a problem with conviction, it looks like. He had a pretty big problem with conviction. And so, we just don't know. One of the things he may have done is he may have succumbed to the doctrine of the Pharisees. He may have been one who started looking back and saying, "Well, you know, I saw this vision and these things coming out on these animals and stuff. Maybe I didn't interpret that right, you know." And so maybe he started doubting himself. Maybe the teaching of the Pharisee just overwhelmed him. As Yeshua warned his disciples in Matthew 16. Do we have that one there? Matthew 16, 11.
"How is it that you do not understand
that I spake it not to you, concerning bread, that ye should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees? Then understood they how that he bade them not beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees." Yeah, so, you know, Yeshua had warned them that the Pharisees and the Sadducees would get involved, and they were going to try to sway you guys. And they did Peter. They got hold of Peter, and they got him swayed off in this thing. And it could have been he was just succumbing to peer pressure. I mean, you have all these guys come from Jerusalem, the capital, you know. The great synagogue is in Jerusalem. And so maybe because these guys came from Jerusalem, we had assumed they came from Jerusalem since they came from James. And James, by the way, at that time was considered the Nasi, the president of the synagogue. It's recorded in the Talmud that James, the brother of Jesus, was the president of the Sanhedrin. So, you know, here's some great guy. And so these guys come down representing James, and maybe Peter says, "Well, maybe James changed." You know, we just don't know what happened for sure. But we do know this, that James did change. And along with James, I mean, that Peter did change. And when Peter changed, he took along with him Barnabas and a number of the Jews. And so Paul was infuriated. And you can only imagine, if you spent years helping people to see something, or especially taking years to help people to overcome this feeling of inferiority that I'm sure the Jews conveyed to most of the people that came around them, Paul was just beside himself. Just beside himself. And Paul did something that we've been warned not to do, and I think warned incorrectly not to do, and Paul committed what's called Lashon Hara, or the evil tongue. Now, that's sort of a modern day term, Lashon Hara. It became real popular about 200 years ago, and I don't necessarily think that Lashon Hara would properly be applied here. But what Paul did, because of his frustration, he took and wrote, or he went and rebuked Peter to his face. And the phrase that's used there in the Greek implies that it was done openly. It was done openly to Peter's face, which you would assume would include everybody around him. And we know that he did it He was open enough about it that he wrote it down in a letter that he sent to the Galatians. Now, he may not have thought it would have been read for the next 2,000 years, but it was and has been. And so we see that Paul openly rebuked and confronted Peter and made it open to the world to see. Now, what Paul was actually doing, we might call it Lashon Hara, the evil tongue, but I would say that it's more closely associated with being his brother's keeper. Because the scripture tells us that when our brother is wrong, this is precisely what we're to do. Did I write down Leviticus 19? Okay. So loving your neighbor as yourself is rebuking your brother when your brother is wrong. That's what you do within community. That's what you do when you have people you love and you want to see them as well as everybody else move forward and correctly. And we'll see as we go on through here that what Peter did was indeed sinful. That by him doing what he did, it was indeed sinful. So let's move on now to Galatians chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. 14 through 16. Okay, that makes a lot of sense, right? Go ahead and explain that, Larry. Kathy?
I have a question. Been waiting. Okay. If you who are a Jew live like a Gentile, explain that.
Okay, that's what we're going to do. Because it makes absolutely no sense to me. And or at least it didn't. It didn't. I've read this numerous times, and maybe everybody else understands that, but I have a hard time sometimes. But what we're going to do is we're going to lay a little bit of groundwork on this before we get into this. First off, I want to go back to this word. Read that again, would you, Elizabeth? The first sentence there. Did you use the word straightforward? Did she move forward? Okay, not uprightly, not uprightly. Okay, in the English Standard Version, it says not in step. And the Hebrew word is orthopodia, orthopodia. Now, ortho, what is an orthodontist? He's someone who keeps your teeth straight, right? He puts braces on you to keep your teeth straight. Ortho means straight. What is a pediatrician? It's podiatrist or whatever it is. It's the guy that works on your feet, okay? Okay. Orthopodia means straight walk. Straight walk. So Paul saying, but when I saw that their conduct, that's Peter, Barnabas, the contingency from Jerusalem, and the Jews that followed along with Peter and Barnabas, they were no longer walking the straight walk. Instead, what they were doing is they were deviating off the path. They were getting off the path. Yes, Kathy?
Mine says, but when I saw that they were deviating
right
from the truth of the gospel.
Yeah, they were deviating off the straight path, the straight walk. God says the walk is narrow, right? Don't go the broad way, you go the narrow, okay? It's a narrow path. Walk the narrow path. Well, they were getting off the path. And so Paul says that when he saw that, he said, I went straight to Peter. Okay? And from that point to the end of this chapter, this is one long rebuke. And you got to keep this in mind. This is one long rebuke. This is this from this point to the end of this chapter, you have Paul hammering on Peter. And he hammers, and he hammers, and he hammers on Peter this whole time. Oftentimes we get to looking at this and we start thinking this is some theological treatise. It's not. It's Paul in the face of Peter from this point forward. And we'll see that. Okay, so here's Paul is, or Peter's not in step. And so Paul makes this statement to Peter. He starts off and says, if you, being a Jew, live in the manner of the Gentiles, not as the Jews, why do you compel the Gentiles to live as Jews? And we're supposed to understand that. Okay? And we can understand it, and we'll get there. But I want to give you a couple of ideas from other people of what they think this means. And the first one is from Tim Haig. Tim Haig is a has a website that's called... it just slipped my mind. Anyway, you can Google Tim Haig. Tim Haig is bright. I mean, he is really sharp. And he's Jewish. And so he's very sharp. But what Tim Haig says about this, he says that it's obviously very puzzling, and he goes through a whole number of things to try to explain this, but his bottom line statement on this is that it should read like this. This is what he says. It says, if you, Peter, a Jew, are going to represent the Jewish people with your lies and hypocrisy, then the Jews are just like these pagan Gentiles, and not like the upright people they claim to be. Thus, why would you persuade the Gentiles to be like Jews? Why not just leave them alone? Did you see that? Okay, basically what Paul is saying here, according to Tim Haig, is that Paul is saying to Peter, Peter, if you, a Jew, are trying to tell, or if you, a Jew, are trying to live, if you, a Jew, are trying to represent the Jewish people with lies and hypocrisy, which is what Peter was doing, he was lying and being hypocritical. We can't really say he was lying, but he was being hypocritical. Then the Jews are just like the pagan Gentiles, because the pagan Gentiles are lying and are hypocrites. And if you're going to do that and be not like the upright Jewish people claim to be, then why would you persuade the Gentiles to be like Jews? In other words, he's saying you're portraying the Jewish people. If the Gentiles are supposed to look at you as an example of the Jewish people, they're going to see someone who lies and is a hypocrite. And so why would you want to convince these Gentiles to be liars and hypocrites? Is basically what he's saying. Okay? Now that's I said this is what Tim Haig said. This is not exactly what Tim Haig said. This is what you gather from all the little things that Tim Haig puts together.
He's still connected with First Prince.
No longer. So anyway, this is one view of it. Now there's another view, and it's put out by Avi Ben Mordecai in his book, Galatians. That's the name of the book, Galatians. And but he gets it out of the Aramaic English New Testament by Andrew Gabriel Roth. And what the Aramaic English New Testament is, it's a translation into Hebrew, the Aramaic Peshitta. Now, anybody know what the Peshitta is? Okay. Go ahead and explain it to us.
Part of a Hebrew original, but since Aramaic is a lot closer in thought and structure to Hebrew than Greek is, the Eastern Orthodox Church considers that they have the better text to base their New Testament on.
Right. That's precisely correct. It's a Syriac, it's called a Syriac text because it comes from Syria, and it just so happens that Antioch was in the northern edge of Syria, and they believe that many of the churches that were raised up by Paul and the apostles that were in that whole Turkish, northern Syria, Asia Minor area, they're the ones that preserved these early letters, and they were originally written in Aramaic. And so this is what the Peshitta is. There's also Peshitta for the Old Testament as well. So anyway, Andrew Gabriel Roth knows Aramaic real well, so he translated the Peshitta into English. He's one of many who have done so, but what he did is he took and used some of the Hebrew roots nuances of it and put some of that in there. But anyway, in the Peshitta, a very interesting thing happens, and this is why it's important, and that is that in the Peshitta, about half the time that in the New Testament, where in our New Testament we have the word Gentile, in the Peshitta they use the word Aramean. Okay, Aramean. Now, Aramean is a very important word because we see this term Aramean in Genesis 25:20. Okay, where she's saying Syrian, in both translations they have Aramean, because it means the same thing. They're all from the same area. Okay, so the Syrians and the Arameans were the same thing. In fact, there's a blessing that we're supposed to say when we bring for our first fruits up, and it's found in Deuteronomy 26, verse 5, and it starts off by saying, "My father was a wandering Aramean." Okay? And all the Israelites' father or grandfather was Laban. Okay? We always think it was just Isaac as a grandfather. But they had another grandfather, and that was Laban. So, I guess you could say all of them. Not all of them. The ones that came from the wives, from Leah and Rachel. But the children of the actual children of Leah and Rachel were still considered from the concubines were still considered Leah's and Rachel's, and so you could still say yeah all 12 tribes then had Aramean in them. They're all Aramean blood.
Do you know what the concubines were?
No.
Do we know?
And so if the Peshitta uses Aramean, and we know that the Arameans were Semitic people, then it's quite likely that the Arameans being spoken of were Israelites. Quite likely. And you put that with all the other evidence available, and we can see probably pretty clearly that they were Israelites. So anyway, in the Aramaic English New Testament, that verse that we're questioning right now, which in English is, "If you, being a Jew, live the manner of the Gentiles, not as the Jews, why do you compel the Gentiles to live as Jews?" In the Aramaic English New Testament, it reads like this: "If you who are Judeans live as Arameans, why do you encourage the Gentiles who have joined themselves to Judah to live like Judeans?" Okay? Now, let's get the characters right. If you who are Judeans live as Arameans. Okay, what that's saying is if you are a Judean, the Judeans are the Jews. Okay, live like the Arameans. And who are the Arameans? They were the Israelites. Now, what were the Arameans in the first century known for? What were the Israelites known for, especially by the Jews? They were the Samaritans. Remember, what did the Jews call the Samaritans? Dogs. Okay, they were dogs. They were junk. There was no love between the Jews and the non-Jewish Israelites. Remember the northern tribes are the ones that God had to send off. They were the ones that were so steeped in idolatry. even though Jeremiah 3:8 says that the Jews were more into idolatry than were the Jews or the Israelites. So anyway, we have this here, and this is the problem here that we're seeing, or this is one of the things we could see in this. So what they're saying here is that if you, Peter, live like those worthless Israelites from the northern tribes, why do you encourage the Gentiles who have joined themselves to Judah to live as Judeans? All right, so in other words, if Peter is going to be a representative of the northern tribes in his conduct, why would you want the Gentiles to be like that? That's the question. All right, so there again, these first two pretty much match each other in this understanding. Okay, so those are two. I don't think either of them really get the picture, and I think the reason why they don't is because there's something in here we don't see. And in order to be able to see what we don't see, we need to read the next verse in Galatians, which is Galatians 2:15.
We who are Jews by nature and not sinners of the Gentiles.
Okay, that's all it says. Doesn't seem to make much sense, does it? Okay, all right, now, this is my theory. This is my theory. I believe that phrase was put in there. I think it's supposed to be there. And I think that Paul actually said it. And I think Paul actually said it right then. But what I think Paul did is he said it under his breath. And he was being very sarcastic in saying it. It's sort of like he's being facetious. He was basically saying, okay, you know, he just gets through telling Peter, you know, if you're going to do this, why are you doing that? And then he says, you stupid idiot. You know how we do. We say something under our breath. We want them to hear it, but we don't really want them to hear it, you know. We want them to get a glimpse of what we said, but we really don't want to really come out and say it. And so he says, we ourselves are Jews by birth and not Gentile sinners. Well, Paul never believed, or at least he doesn't believe now, that we Jews are better than the Gentiles, does he? He's hammering Peter because Peter does, at least by his actions, think that the Jews are better than the Gentiles. But Paul doesn't believe that. And so why would Paul say that? He's making fun. He's mocking Peter. He's mocking him. Remember, he's hammering on Peter right now. So he's mocking Peter. He's saying, we're just, you know, we Jews, we're so good, you know. It sounds boastful if you read it the way it's read, but he's not boasting at all. He's making fun of Paul, or of Peter. And I tell you how you can understand this. Because let's go back now and let's read this chapter, verse 14. Let's read verse 14 where it starts with, if you being a Jew, and let's skip verse 15 and then read on.
If you being a Jew, livest after the manner of Gentiles and not as do the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews? Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ. Even we have believed in Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by the faith of Christ, and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified.
Okay, so do you see the flow there? If you've got your Bible open to it, read right over it and read right past this verse 15. And you'll see that it flows there. There's a good flow to it. Let me read it again here. If you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile, not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews, knowing that such and such and such and such? So I would submit to you that this is totally a interjected phrase that Paul is doing to basically hammer harder at Peter for what Peter has done. Because Paul doesn't believe what he just got through saying there in verse 15. He just doesn't believe it. He doesn't teach it. So it has to be a him being, simply being facetious. So there again, putting the two together with that verse 15, if you being a Jew live in the manner of the Gentiles and not as the Jews, why do you compel the Gentiles to live as Jews, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law? Okay, so if you read it there, it makes a lot more sense, especially if you look at the meaning of the words. Because unfortunately for us, in the English Bibles, we have the word Jew in that phrase three times, but in the Greek, it's three different words. It's three different words in the Greek. And I'll show you what they are. In the first place where it says, if you being a Jew, that word there in Greek is iodas. Iodas. It's Strong's number 2453. And it means belonging to the Jewish race. Jewish race. So basically what he's saying there, if you being a racial Jew, you were born a Jew. And all three of these words are all rooted together, and they're all different forms of the word iota or Judah, which is Strong's number 2448. But the first one there is speaks specifically of you being a racial Jew. The second word in there, where it says, "If you being a Jew live in the manner of the Gentiles and not like the Jews," that word there is iodakos. Iodakos. That's Strong's number 2452. And that means Jewishly, or after the manner of the Jews. So where the first word spoke specifically of someone of the Jewish race, this is speaking of someone who lives after the manner of the Jews. Okay, not necessarily Jewish, but after the manner of the Jews.
Traditions, in other words.
Traditions. And the third place we see it, is where it's at the end there. Why do you compel the Gentiles to live as Jews? That word is still a different word. That word is iodazo, or something like that. And it's Strong's number 2450. And it means a one who has adopted Jewish customs. Now, this second word is very important to us. And Nathan brought that out. And to get a better idea of that word, I want us to read Titus chapter 1, verses 7 through 14. Titus 1, 7 through 14. This passage is about the requirements for an overseer in the congregation. Okay, so what Paul has told Peter or Titus is that you've got to watch out for some people. You don't want them to be overseers of your congregations. And he specifically said that there were some of those who were from the circumcision, which means what? They were Jewish, okay? All right. And then he says, because they will teach you Jewish fables and commandments of men. Jewish fables and commandments of men. I'm going to tell you a Jewish fable. A Jewish fable is that when God gave the Torah to Moses, he also gave an unwritten verbal Torah to Moses that Moses conveyed verbally down through the ages, and it has been conveyed for now 3,500 years, and it's still intact. Perfectly intact. Okay? This is what the Jews will tell you today. That their oral law was given orally to Moses and has not changed in 3,500 years. Is that a fable or is that not? I would put that under the guise of fable. All right? And then we also know that the Jews teach for, as law, the commandments of men, right? All right. Well, that term that was used there to describe who these people were is this Greek word, iodeikos, Strong's number 2452. And it deals specifically with people who make up their own laws, And don't get me wrong, I'm not against Jewish Judaism, and I think there's some good oral law out there that we can learn from and all that stuff. But for the purposes of this, we need to understand what Paul was saying in this regard. So when we take and put these correct Jewish terms, correct Greek terms, into this passage that seems so confusing, we can make a little bit more sense of it, especially if we leave that middle verse 15 out of there that doesn't seem to fit. And when you do so, this is the variation, or this is the way I would say the passage would read. And I'm putting in some explanation as I go. This is how I believe it would read. And I think this is the intent of what Paul was saying. If you, Peter, being born a Jew, live in the manner of the Gentiles, i.e., free from the oral law, because the Gentiles at this time were free from the oral law. They weren't participating in the oral law. If you, being born a Jew, live in the manner of the Gentiles, that is, being free from the oral law, and not as the Jews who submit to oral law, why do you, by your actions, compel the Gentiles to submit to Jewish oral law? Does that make sense? This is the whole crux of the matter. I mean, this is the whole problem. This oral law is being interjected in here. And so I think that what we see here is when in Paul's rebuke of Peter, he's basically saying, Peter, by your actions, you're trying to enforce oral law back on these people that you yourself have said is not applicable. And this is where I think Paul is in this regard. And then Paul goes on to say, and this is paraphrasing it, how can you do that knowing that we're not justified by works of the law, but by faith in Messiah Yeshua? Now, why do I say that? Because if you look at the way it's written there, well, let me go on to that here. I'm a little bit ahead of myself. We know that Peter knew that Torah obedience did not justify a person. The term justify, I'm not going to get really into this, but the word justify in this regards here, where it's used here, it simply means acquitted. That a person's not acquitted by their Torah observance. In other words, and we understand that today, okay? You cannot take you cannot take and kill your neighbor's goat and eat it and then be justified before him by not going out and killing any other neighbor's goats, can you? No, you've got to pay him back, don't you? There's a penalty that has to be paid. So to think that you could be justified for your breaking the law by keeping the law is ridiculous. We know that today, you know. There's not a court in the world that's going to say, well, you didn't pay your taxes this year, but, you know, you didn't pay your taxes 3 years ago, but since you've paid them every year since then, you're okay. No, they're still going to make you pay your taxes from 2 years ago. So you're not justified by continuing to keep the law if you've broken the law before. There's still a penalty has to be paid. We understand that. And this is all that Paul is saying here. You know, Peter, you know that the law can't justify a person. How can you get convince these Gentiles to do to believe and trust in God if you're trying to force oral law down them for their justification? This is what he goes on. And then Paul goes on to say, and paraphrasing again, we did believe that, didn't we? Okay, read it there. Verse 16, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ, even we have believed that. Why did he put a past tense in there? If he was saying, we still believe that, don't we? Then we do believe that. But Paul says, we have believed that. He's saying, we believe that, don't we? You know, this is what we agreed on, isn't it? You know, when we had this handshake up in Jerusalem, isn't this what we all agreed to?
Yeah, and the reason he said it the way he does here is because what Peter and them are doing, it's obvious they have stepped back from the faith that Paul originally taught these people.
Right.
And the faith that Peter and then Barnabas had all agreed to back in Jerusalem.
Well, and also just think about it this way. If you were correcting somebody, this is what you would do.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is exactly the way we would correct somebody. We wouldn't go up there with flowing words and all this theology and all that stuff. We'd be in their face. And this is exactly what Paul's doing. Notice how it's worded in the many King James translations. It says, even we, in the King James Version says, even we have believed. In the English Standard Version it says, so we also have believed. In the Young's Literal Translation, also we in Jesus Christ did believe. He's not saying we do believe this, because he's wondering if Paul or Peter still does believe it or not. Do you believe, Peter, what we talked about? This is what he's asking him. All right, let's move on then to Galatians 2, verses 17 through 18.
But if while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves also are found sinners, is therefore Christ the minister of sin? God forbid. For if I build again the things which I destroyed, I make myself a transgressor.
Okay, now this is again, it's a little bit hard to understand, especially outside of the context. We've got to understand the context. And I'm just going to go over it real quickly here. You've got to understand the context of the first century Jewish people in regards to non-Jews. And it basically goes like this. A non-Jew must convert to Judaism to have a place in the world to come. That's it. A non-Jew must convert to Judaism to have a place in the world to come. That doesn't necessarily mean that if you're a Jew, you have a place in the world to come, because if you're not a righteous Jew, you don't have a place. But the point is this, you can be as righteous as Joseph, because God calls Joseph the father of Jesus, a just man. You can be as righteous as Joseph, but if you're not Jewish, that means nothing to the first century Jewish people. You have to be Jewish or you have to convert to Judaism. So anybody who does not convert to Judaism, or someone who teaches someone to not convert to Judaism, is still a sinner. You are a pagan. Because in the Judaism of the first century, there is two groups of people. There was Jews and there was pagans. That's it. In the Jewish mindset, at least. And so, what Paul is saying here is that... Let me read it again here. If we endeavor to be justified by Christ, and the Jews still look at us as sinners, which they would, because justification by Christ instead of justification by oral law is two different things, right? And so if you're not, if We are willing to be justified by Christ instead of justified by oral law, or even by written law for that matter, then we know that there's going to be Jews out there who think we're sinners. Okay? We know that's going to be the case, and we're just going to have to get over it. We've just got to get over it. Let's see, where am I? Oh, here it is. So, this is the question then. This is the question that, that's not a question. This is the statement that Paul is making. But if in our endeavor to be justified by Christ, in other words, if we're going to promote being justified by Messiah Yeshua instead of by oral law or by written Torah, then yes, we're going to be considered sinners. That's fine with us. Does that make Christ a servant of sin? And there again, to understand that term servant of sin, you got to look a little bit at the Hebrew or the Greek there. And the Greek word there for servant is the word diakonos. Diakonos, we get the term deacon from that word. And what is a deacon? The first place we see the term deacon used in the New Testament is when the disciples were saying that do we have time to do what? Wait tables. All right? What's this whole discussion about? Sitting down and eating food together, eating at a table. And so Paul is basically using a play on words here and saying, is Yeshua out there waiting on tables to a bunch of pagans? Is what we are doing by having Jew and non-Jew coming together, is Yeshua right in the midst of it and he's waiting the tables for us? He's serving at these tables for us? Because Peter, if what you're saying is correct, then you're saying that this is precisely what Yeshua is doing. And by saying that that's precisely what Yeshua is doing, that what does that make Yeshua? A sinner. Makes him a sinner. Because if it's a sin for Jews and non-Jews to eat together, and here's Yeshua out there feeding Jews and non-Jews, what does that make him? He's an accomplice in the crime, isn't he? So he's a sinner himself. And so Paul's just got through saying, Paul, Peter, you just, not only are you being a hypocrite, not only are you causing all kinds of confusion, you also just got through calling our Messiah a sinner, is what you've done. The way I paraphrased it here is like this. If we teach that we are justified by belief in Yeshua, and some Jewish believers take that as sin because we don't require conversion to Judaism, then those fellows must believe that Yeshua is promoting sin by encouraging us to eat together. Does it not? I believe this is what Paul's saying to Peter. Remember, Paul is in his face. Paul is not giving him any slack. And after saying that, where does that leave Peter? I mean, Paul, I think, has laid a pretty good case. And Peter would probably have nothing to say but, you're right. You're right. You have nailed me. Because I have certainly blown it. I have certainly misrepresented what Messiah has done. And see, Peter shouldn't have done that. Peter was closer to Messiah than anyone but John. But Peter blew it. He had no choice but to agree with Paul. But Paul's not finished. He's still got some more. So Paul goes on to say that Peter not only implied by his actions that Yeshua is a sinner, but that Yeshua was also rebuilding a wall between Jew and non-Jew. He was putting that wall back up. But Paul's saying, I want no part of it. I'm not going to be a part of this hypocrisy. For if I were to do so, then I would transgress Torah. Because it says in Matthew 15, verses 2 and 3. Go ahead and read that.
Why do thy disciples transgress
So here is Peter out there, and he's transgressing the law of God by tradition. So Peter has himself committed a great sin in doing this. He's misinterpreting Torah. He's misinterpreting Messiah. I mean, he's doing at least a number of different things, no matter what his motivation for doing these things are. But Peter is obviously wrong. And so Paul is still at it. He doesn't let up. And he goes on, Galatians 2, verses 19 through 21. And let me preface what she just read by saying this. Peter, for though the law, or through the law, I died to the law. Okay? He's in Peter's face. He's talking to Peter specifically right now. He's not talking to us. He's talking to Peter. And what Paul is telling Peter is this. Peter, I'm a changed guy. I may have been something before, but I have changed. I no longer want to rid Judaism of these Christians because we misrepresented these Christians. We misunderstood these fellas. They're not idolaters like we talked about. I'm adding some things in here, obviously. And Peter, I died to this stuff. I died to that. I'm not going to resurrect that. I'm not going to bring it back up. You should have died to it too, Peter, but you didn't, obviously. By your actions, but I died to it, and I'm not going to bring it back up. I'm not going to get involved in your hypocrisy, Peter, because I now live to this gospel. This gospel is my life. And what is that gospel? That gospel is the reunification of the 12 tribes of Israel and the restoration of the kingdom of God. And Peter, you're frustrating that. You're frustrating that. My old self is gone. I now live for Messiah. I'm going to promote Messiah's message, not my own message, and not the message of the Jews. I'm going to promote the message of Messiah. And by the way, Peter, I don't set aside the grace Yahweh has given me by compromising my convictions when it's convenient to do so like you did. If we ever teach that we're justified by the law, then there is no need for Yeshua to die in the first place. And that's where Paul leaves it. So, the conclusion of this is that, with this open and deliberate rebuke of Peter, Paul clearly shows that the gospel message he's been given is something he truly believes. Remember, this whole thing here is all a part of trying to help the Galatian people to understand Paul's conviction to this message. And so Paul's open rebuke of Peter was included in this so that the Galatian people can understand that Paul's a genuine man. And he's willing to stand up even to the leadership of this whole thing. Because Peter and James and John, they were the pillars. But when they're wrong, they're wrong. Paul's message was given to him by inspiration. He checked it out. He took it to Jerusalem to make sure he understood it correctly. And he was willing to defend it at all costs, even if it meant to be ostracized by his colleagues and the Jewish community. And so at this point, Paul is now ready to confront the Galatians and ask them why you turned from this gospel message that you were given. So, I know this took a little bit of time, but I think it's important for us to understand where this was, what this whole thing was about. Unfortunately, most commentators want to make a theological thing out of this. This was not theology. This was a man who was angry, and he had righteous indignation, hammering at one of the leaders in the Messianic movement of his day, because he was wrong. All right.